Pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
On today's episode of On the Wing podcast, I'm joined by the two veterinarians featured on our Ask a Vet video series with Purina ProPlan, Dr. Ruth Ann Lobos and Dr. Seth Bynum. In case you haven't been following along, we started this series of video shorts last September based on crowdsourced the listeners and our social media followers on Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's channels, crowdsourced bird dog questions. So those questions were the genesis of a video series that started in September and have been coming out once a month ever since then. On today's episode of On the Wing podcast, I've got two goals. First, I want all of our listeners to learn a little bit more about these veterinarians, who they are as people, as hunters, and maybe that'll help shape some of their answers in the video series a little bit more. And then second, I'm going to hit on just a point or two on each video that really pulled me in with the hopes that we'll bounce you back to the video series to check them out. They're super well done. Purina ProPlan has sponsored these, and they're a longtime partner, and we're really proud of them. And so we're hoping our podcast listeners will jump back into the video series. They're all on YouTube and can take a look and then also read the blogs that go with them. So without further ado, go Tigers.
Go Ruth Tigers.
Ruth Ann, Seth, thank you for joining me. We'll start with Ruth Ann. Go Tigers, because in the pregame of this, you're like, well, we got to talk about LSU athletics. So tell me about where you grew up, because you don't have a Cajun accent. So how does LSU fit into this?
Right. I like to throw people off by not having the Cajun accent. Although if I talk to my family, it comes out with a vengeance. It does. So grew up in Baton Rouge. That's where I went to undergrad and to vet school. So from the time I was knee high to a grasshopper, I was going to LSU football games with my dad. And
so give us a little, let it, because I can, oh dear, yeah, real fine, yeah, hold my beer, eh? I'm going to try something. My Uper accent, eh? So I have not a Cajun accent, but if I want to, I can bring out the Uper accent.
Yeah, you can bring
let's
it
hear
out.
Some Cajun.
Well, so then it, so to thicken the plot, both my parents are from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And then coincidentally, I married a boy from Green Bay, Wisconsin, when we met in Austin, Texas. So it is all just kind of this mishmash. But if you did do a blood draw on me, it would be purple and gold.
Okay. So
I'm a diehard of all LSU sports, and I'm fortunate that we are pretty successful across the board, from college football to baseball to women's basketball. It's not a hard university to be a fan of.
Seth just shaking his head.
Just waiting for my turn.
Yeah. So can you bring out the Cajun accent? Like if you pretend that you're talking to, do you have a brother?
I do have a brother.
Okay,
yeah,
so,
and two sisters. Yeah.
Well, I'll be a brother. Seth will be a sister.
I can't. I am not a Labrador that can sit on command.
Oh, come on.
But I'll bring it out. Don't you worry. It'll come out. I promise.
So you got both parents from Milwaukee.
Yeah.
And you married a guy from Green Bay, so
yeah.
You spent some time in Wisconsin, I imagine?
We still go back in vacation, but I grew up in Baton Rouge for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. And then spent a few years in Austin, Texas before. Now I'm based out of Boulder, Colorado.
Okay. And where you went to LSU for your veterinary degree?
Yeah, for undergrad and for vet school. Yeah.
And give us a little bit of your career trajectory, how you ended up at Purina.
I know we only, you know, we have a short time here, so I won't take you through all the details. When I was growing up, my mom always had a book of all things like for your elementary school. So you would write down your favorite teacher, your favorite, you know, color that month or that year, you know, what awards, what sports you played, all that. What did you want to be when you grow up? When I was in kindergarten, I wrote that I wanted to be a cat when I grew up. Oddly enough,
Seth is taking notes. Right?
I am way more of a dog person, which makes it even more ironic. But by first grade, I had figured out that I could not actually change species. And so I wanted to be a vet. And it stayed that way throughout my entire, upbringing and education. And I went, after I graduated, I went into private practice, small animal practice in Austin. And it was a great practice. But my dad always told us, he was like, you know, if you get the opportunity for an interview, always take it. You never know, you know, what door is going to open. And I had a classmate of mine call and say, hey, Purina is interested in or is expanding their support of veterinary schools and they're hiring vets. Do you know anybody who is interested? And he was like, I know you're not. And I was like, I had a really bad day at the practice and had some things happen. And I was like, I don't know. I actually might be interested. Ironically, I took mixed animal nutrition going through vet school. And so large animal and small animal mixed together. And I had a paralyzing fear of public speaking. But when I interviewed with Purina and I walked through those doors and I met all the passionate people that work there and make that company who it is, I voluntarily took a job to publicly speak on small animal nutrition. That's how contagious the Purina passion is.
It's a very interesting winding road, you know? Yeah. You wanted to be a cat, became a veterinarian, hated public speaking, became a public speaker. How do you feel about skydiving?
Right. I've been twice. Yeah, and I, you know, and when I took the job, I was like, it's pet food. Like, how exciting could this be? Plus, it's a fair amount of travel. And so I told the guy who was hiring me, Dr. Kurt Venator, and I was like, I could probably do this for like 3, maybe 5 years. 18 years later, I'm still at this company. And really, I just love the fact that I can help to educate owners out there on how to do the best for their dogs. And you know, I still practice on the side. So I'm in a clinic a couple of days a month, being what I call a real vet, like Seth over there. And love it. And Purina supports that as well. So it's been a really great balance.
So let's go to Seth and get your career background. And you've been on the podcast a couple of times before, but so some folks know you, but tell us about where you grew up and lead us up to kind of where you are present day.
Sure. Can we say go Tar Heels? Is that acceptable?
Sure.
We have a little bit of a legacy in the basketball realm, at least, if not
we football. Got a Carolina LSU battle going on.
Yeah. So I'm a North Carolina native, and I went to undergrad for the first time at UNC. So that was my one pathway in. And I was, unlike Ruth Ann, I'd never thought about being a veterinarian until I was much older. In fact, I don't think I was mature or capable enough as an 18-year-old to take the courses required to even apply. So I was, for a brief period of time, what they called then, which is now sort of Parks and Rec Management, was called at North Carolina Leisure Studies. And you can imagine when I switched
Did they give you a suit?
No, not leisure suit. More like R&R kind of leisure, which was right up my alley at the time. And imagine the story of telling your dad who, you know, you told him you're going to be a business major that you switched on his dime to leisure studies. He was.
Did you really do
it? I did. I had to. It didn't occur to me at the time. I'm like, why is he not stoked for me? It's like, oh, I get it now, what that means. So what I really wanted to do, I fell in love with fly fishing, really. And this has nothing to do with pheasants, but I'll get there or be a veterinarian for that matter. So I moved out to Montana when I was 21. I'd never even been there, but I knew that's the place I wanted to go and tried to make a living that would allow me to fish as often as possible. And I was pretty successful for quite a while. And then moved to Washington State, met my wife, who's an Eastern Montana native, and we lived in Western Washington for a while. And then it was really bird dog. Well, backtrack to Montana. I lived in eastern Montana. It turns out I wasn't even a hunter at the time. Mm. So I lived in a place... I was an avid fisherman, but did not hunt. And I was like, I should probably try this out. I hear this part of Montana is decent with the upland birds. So from the first time I ever gave it a go, I was totally hooked. Yeah. And then I knew that I had to have a dog. And it was really bird dogs that drove me to be a veterinarian. I was really? Just completely smitten with them, fascinated at their physiology, the way they moved, the way they hunted, and everything about them. I was like, I don't know. I can't be a fly fishing guide my whole life, maybe I could be a veterinarian. Who knows? And so it started the long slog back to like pretty much 3/4 of another undergraduate degree on short track and applied to vet school at 33.
Really?
Yeah. So yeah, I was in the meantime, when I wasn't fishing or bird hunting, I was a journalist and was a photographer and writer for a lot of years. So
now it takes a lot of courage to change careers at 33.
It didn't feel like courage. It felt like stupid, really. I knew it'd be a big financial undertaking. And honestly, I didn't think I'd be able to do it. I thought, well, somewhere along this path to where I won't get into vet school, I'll stumble upon something that ignites me. But I just knew it had to be around sporting dogs. Hmm. So,
to be a veterinarian, you have doctorates. I mean, how much different is that than being a human doctor? I mean, my perception is it's not a whole hell of a lot different. I mean,
it's harder if you really want to get into the crux of it. Yeah. Well, I mean, if we look at now, granted, both Seth and I mostly focus on small animals, so dogs and cats. But, you know, we had to learn all of them, all the species.
Different animals, yeah.
So, and, you know.
Not just human beings.
Right, yeah. Right. So ruminants are going to have a whole different, obviously, digestive tract. Yeah. And different drugs react differently. They have different types of metabolisms, things like that. So it can be more complicated. And our patients don't talk to us. So that, I think,
right.
That in itself.
What's going on?
Yeah.
You got to interpret.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Here's another thing. And this is me saying it, right? Yeah. Not on the veterinarians, but interested to get your reaction. I think there's a personality difference. Now, granted, I meet a ton of veterinarians, and a lot of them are, you know, in this sort of setting, podcasts, radio interviews, you know, so they're naturally outgoing, extroverted. It feels like veterinarians have to be a little bit more, I don't know, just outwardly friendly, easygoing, get along with people. Like doctors, maybe it's just a matter of like they have such crushing schedules. I'm not saying you don't, but it's more sort of just running the numbers. Have you ever had that perception? Like veterinarians are just easygoing, happier people.
Well, we could go down a deep rabbit hole with this one, but we actually, unfortunately, in our profession, have the highest rate of suicide and drug and alcohol
kidding.
Use. Yeah.
Well, so yeah. I've met the happy ones.
You've met the happy ones,
holy
or you make
cow.
Them happy.
Why do you think that is?
I mean, I think it's, I mean, there's a lot of factors that go in. It's a
traumatic at times.
Yeah. And then you wear a number of hats. So you are trying to be a medical professional. Oftentimes, money comes as a factor of what a family either wants to or can afford. So then you're trying to guess what's happening without being able to run the blood work or the x-rays or the ultrasound or the MRI or CT or whatever it is that we can do. And so then you're playing like you're a financial advisor for the family.
Oh my gosh.
If one person in the family thinks it's time and the other one isn't ready, then you're also playing family counselor.
Oh man.
So it's a... There's a lot that goes into it, and people look for outsources to get rid of that stress. I mean, it's no different from like the rest of the medical field, I would say, in finding like good technicians, because a good technician is going to make, you know, it's going to make your day, and a bad one is going to really, really break it. And so there's a lot that goes into the people management side of it that people oftentimes don't, you know, take into consideration.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I feel the dark cloud rolling over your podcast right now.
I know. Sorry. It's downer.
It is completely incongruent to my perception. Because it's like you got, you know, you two are just so happy all the time. Shiny, happy people. Come on.
Well, you haven't talked to our spouses yet. Though, well,
right. The vets that I interact with in Twin City, they always seem so jovial and happy. And I don't know, maybe it just, they like seeing German short hairs. I don't know.
That's right.
Well, when I get well-behaved patients in the clinic and good owners, it's like the highlight of my day oftentimes. So you're probably seeing the best they have to offer. Sure. You're making them happy.
So, Seth, you brought us towards hunting, and you mentioned that bird dogs brought you to be a veterinarian. You know, as we watch this series, and it's all focused on taking care of your bird dogs, you know, I know people are wondering, well, what kind of dogs, what kind of hunting do these two do, you know? Like, so that's part of the podcast here, and my goal is to get people to connect with you and understand what, you know, you're seeing the world through similar eyes to how they see the world. So start with Seth. I know you're a hardcore bird hunter. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what kind of pups you got at home, what you enjoy doing in your free time. Give us your, you know, some of your favorites, whatever comes to mind, the birds you like to chase, the places you like to go. Connect with our audience a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I didn't finish my story in terms of that I now live in Idaho. So I made it all the way to Washington and have trickled back a little bit east. And I really like where I'm at now because it offers a diversity of species to hunt. I don't want to pump up Idaho too much. It's already parts of it are getting kind of found out and discovered. But I am I'm a German short hair guy like you, and that's the only pointing breed I've ever had. And I don't see myself going any other direction.
Really?
There's so many flavors within the breed itself. Different pedigrees, different lines, different hunting styles, and I'm dabbling in a new part of it right now that I just love. So I've got a 2-year-old and an 8-year-old, and we just lost my 14-year-old in the fall.
Sorry,
it's
tough.
Yeah, he beat cancer, but an errant toothpick got him at the end. But it
come
was,
on,
I know it was a crazy story. But he was a fantastic dog. He was the one that just like inspired me to be a vet. So he's a very symbolic dog and motivational.
What was
dog.
That pup's name?
River.
River.
Yeah, he was 14. He had cancer for 2 years and kind of fought it
off.
What's
the toothpick story?
Well, so we all had this plan that he was going to go from cancer, right? So but he's still 14 and still hunting. I mean, you kind of had to set things up for him a little bit for, you know, so he have a good experience. But the last week of life, he hunted 2 days, put in maybe 8 to 10 miles a day in those times, retrieve birds. Even with cancer in his mouth, he loved retrieve birds.
Dang.
And then we had a birthday party for my daughter. And then there were these little mozzarella and tomato skewers. And I cleaned up the house like a champ, but some kid had wandered outside and I think ate the tomato, pitched the mozzarella stick in the toothpick, and then I heard him out there coughing and gagging, and then I saw half of a mozzarella ball come flying out, and he continued to be ill, and then within 24 hours he was infected and then just spiraled quickly. And at his age, knowing his other concurrent diseases, we didn't do anything heroic, but it's, you know, they never, we had just pictured him that one day the cancer will get the leg up and we'll know what to do, and I feel that cloud rolling back in on our conversation again.
I asked. every bird dog owner knows that there's an ending like this.
Yeah, and, all too often.
Yeah, but you had 14 tremendous years with that pup and changed the trajectory of your life.
Yes, it did. Yeah. He was pretty phenomenal. But this new dog is completely the opposite, and he's now the best. And
I tell phenomenal.
Well, in the way that he hunts and works, and it's he's phenomenal in a different way. Yeah. You know, and so I do miss the old guy and all that he did for me personally. But now I'm in this stage where it's okay to have favorite dog. Like I don't maybe choose a favorite child, but I'll tell you which dog is my favorite. And the 2-year old, now he's a rock star. So
and what's a 2-year old's name?
His name is Stellar. So
Stellar.
I gave him that name. Yeah. It's like with the expectation these are pretty big shoes you have to fill. So he's done a good job so far.
Favorite birds to hunt? Where do you like to go? What just off top of your head?
Sure, chuckers would be my top, I think, just because the challenge and the scenery is just top shelf all around. It's the perfect big running pointing dog bird. I mean, it's just, the things you see in that country, it's unparalleled anywhere else. But if I had to choose a second, I'd say right now is probably the ruffed grouse. Mm. I think the, and I have great hunting of both, right, not very far from my house, which is kind of unique. Just the challenge they provide. I just love it. The habitat's different.
So chuckers, one of the birds I have not hunted, and I'll be honest, I'm scared of my hunting with my dogs on chuckers. Should I be? Like, I'm scared my dogs will go off a cliff.
Maybe choose a place that's not Hell's Canyon or something like that. Okay. That's super duper steep and scary. There are lots of places like that. And you have to have a dog that has a brain and then, you know, that will make good choices.
And probably have to be rock solid steady too, right?
Potentially. Yeah. And you have to be steady yourself and say, okay, if my dogs are going to break at the flush and the birds are going to just peek over the edge and, you know, they'll fly right over where my gun barrel is pointed towards my dogs very easily, then I need to have some restraint and be smart about it.
Pick your hunting partners very carefully.
That's why I go alone most of the time. Turns out this is my schedule is best for me just to go by myself.
It's nice to hunt alone too. All right, Ruth Ann, tell us a little bit about your background.
I'm an adult onset hunter. I hunted a little deer when I was in college growing up, but it was always, no one in my family hunted, and it was more of like, if I was dating a guy who hunted, then I would go along. I have an eight point buck to my name, but that was about it.
No more boyfriend.
No more boyfriend.
Exactly.
And when we moved out to Colorado, I'll save the details, but we currently, we had a phrase in our house called that we were the island of misfit pups. Mm. So we had dogs that would come in for one reason or another from the home that previously that didn't work out for them. And we wound up with a yellow Labrador, Finn, who we currently have. And we lost two last year. They were non-hunting dogs. It was a little French bulldog. And then I had a pointer, but she never hunted, that my husband brought into the relationship. And she lived to be almost 18. It was kind of insane.
Wow.
We kept saying, this is going to be Stella's last Christmas. This is going to be Stella's last. And it just, I was like, she's going to live forever. Stella's going to be burying me. Eventually, unfortunately, cancer did get her. But anyway, we had the opportunity. We had friends that were getting separated, and neither one of them wanted Finn. And he was an obedience-trained yellow lab. And we were like, all right, we'll take him. He was about 2.5 when we got him. And he fell in right away, lockstep with the rest of the dogs, and became my running buddy. So I run marathons, half marathons. I'm a recovering triathlete. He was always my running buddy and by my side. Didn't matter the weather or anything like that. And when we moved out to Colorado, my husband started, he was like, well, I think there's pheasant hunting around here. And he had started some duck hunting, but duck hunting and sitting still when it's cold and windy and waiting for the birds to come to you sounds like hell on earth to me.
Testify, sister.
Yeah. So I was like, I don't know if this duck hunting thing is going to be for me. I don't want to get started in that. But then when we started to explore, and he's like, there's a lot of public land out here in western Kansas and, you know, within stone's throw of where we are in Colorado. And he was like, you should just come out and just see Finn. And he's never been formally hunt trained. And now that we are getting older, it is really hard to run behind a Flushing Labrador, especially with those late season roosters. I am a distance runner, not a sprinter. I went out there and saw him, and I was like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And he is in his happy place, and I need whatever I need to do to be able to give this to him for his life. I'm going to do it.
Sweet.
And so I know my story is probably not unique as far as the dog inspiring the hunting and all of that, but I'm forever grateful to him. He just had his 9th birthday back in January, and he is not stopping, which I'm glad. But on a fun, positive, light note for this podcast, we are bringing a puppy home on Thursday. So a wire-haired pointing Griffon.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
One of my favorite bird dog breeds to say.
Right. I always think of you as we were researching, and I did honestly turn over – the next breed picking to responsibilities to my husband. So he really dove in, and we wanted a versatile dog because he does still duck hunt.
Okay.
And I have dabbled in duck hunting. I went twice this past year. Still not sure it's my jam. I still like pheasant and quail are really the two species I have the most familiarity with. I'd love to explore like ptarmigan because it's good. Apparently good hunting out where we are.
And Colorado, like the mountain ptarmigan.
Yeah.
Well, you are a triathlete, so it fits.
Yeah.
Do you have a name for the new Griff?
Yes. So her name is Journey.
That's a cool name.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Who got to pick the name?
I got to pick the name.
Okay, so husband got to pick the breed, you got the name.
That's right. And he named our Frenchie that we had before, so it's only fair that I would get to pick the name.
Awesome. Well, throughout, both of you are super active on Instagram. Seth, you got just unbelievable photography. Like you say,
thanks.
You hunt in beautiful places. What's your Instagram handle? Bird Dog Vet. And then Ruth Ann, you have the running. You have some fun photos of your family. What's your boy's name?
Alexander.
Alexander.
Yep.
You got some LSU Tiger stuff. You got some dog stuff. What's your Instagram handle?
Yeah, so it's Go Tigers DVM. And we spell go.
Misspell.
I mean, I don't know how else you spell it, but in our house, we spell it G-E-A-U-X. That's the only way to spell go.
Go Tigers DVM,
yep.
Doctor of Veterinary Medicine.
That's right. Yep.
Perfect.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing a little bit about yourselves. This series has been going on since September. It's really well done. I mean, we're at our organization, we're really proud of it. It's tremendous content that we get asked a lot for, and now there's video all in one place for people to check out. So I rewatched them all recently, and I took some notes on just one thing that piqued my interest in each to sort of drive listeners back to watch them. So episode one is titled What's in Your Bird Dog First Aid Kit? And Seth, in this one, in episode one, you make the comment, a skin stapler is a really valuable tool in the right hands. Well, I have a skin stapler and it's in the wrong hands. I don't know. I'll admit it. I have it. I've always carried it. I don't know how to use the damn thing.
Yeah.
How should I go into my vet and say, show me how to use it? I mean, is it as straightforward as that? Do I watch YouTube clips? Like, how do I take it from in the wrong hands to putting it in the right hand so I can actually do something useful with it?
Yeah, I just had this flashback of veterinary school. Maybe you had the same thing of using a banana.
That's what I was about to say.
We're talking about a stapler, right?
Right. Yeah. We are. So yeah, go ahead and put a barbed wire cut on the banana at home. That's not too ripe.
Okay.
And then that just sort of mimics tissue and it's like skin tissue and it's like its density and you can practice on that.
Huh.
Yeah, I think people either make one of two major mistakes. I think one, you have to the stapler's part of a package of flushing and cleaning out and then sanitizing a wound.
Okay.
You can't just do one of those things.
Right.
If you're going to choose one, don't choose just the stapler.
Right. Pushing it together and start stapling.
Right. You got to clean
it
up.
It'll be messy.
It needs to be a fresh wound, one that you can clean, one that's, that's reasonable in size, I guess. And that's a pretty subjective thing to say.
Okay.
But that'd be my advice to you. And then just go practice it. There's probably 30 or more staples in that thing preloaded, so you have more than you need for a while, and just get the sense of what it's like, to how much tension you need to put down, and yeah, go for it.
If I were to go into my vet's office, who I have a good enough relationship with, I bring the stapler, could he show me like to do it on something, like not somebody's dog? Hey, test it out on Sparky here.
Right.
I mean, is there has anybody ever done that? Brought a stapler in and, hey, can you show me how to use this real quick?
Yeah, I've actually done that before. And I don't think we used a banana. I think we used a piece of that Elasticon stuff, yeah, okay. Or some kind of like, you know, bandage wrap that you could just kind of punch right into. Because you have to have something that's, you're not going to punch it in the table below.
Right,
so it has to be elevated. But
a banana.
A banana.
Yeah. Okay. Or a sponge. Sometimes we use some of this, like a kitchen sponge that has like the scrubby side on one side of it. And then, yeah, putting a little incision there and
putting them together.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, it. Intimidated by it, but just you got to try it, right?
Yeah.
Well, and I would my add to that would be if you're afraid to use it, don't and stop carrying it in your kit.
Don't pack it.
So one, it's
logical, but
right,
you know,
I know.
Come on,
I know. You want to look cool with all the other hunters out there.
Not even look cool. It's like, well, I should have it. It's the right thing, but I don't know how to use the darn thing. You know.
Yeah.
So all right, episode number two. How do I safely travel with my bird dog? And Ruth Ann, you talked about Fortiflora. And I still think there's pretty good amount of learning to be done within the hunting audience. Okay, what is Fortiflora? Why should I be using it? Give us the veterinarian, like, okay, this is really legitimately important and why.
Yeah, so I love Fortiflora. It came out right when, actually, not too long after I started at Purina. So it's a probiotic. So it's the good live bacteria. And I'll throw out the caveat that one probiotic is not equal to all probiotics. And certainly in the supplement space, there's loose regulation. And so, you know, really making sure there's some sort of guarantee of what's on the outside matches what's on the inside. And that's what with Fortiflora, there's, you know, all kinds of guarantees that it's the live bacteria, but it's so critical. We see, I mean, I think GI, you know, issues are the number one reason why people bring their dogs to the veterinarian just in general. And then, but then when you look at what our dogs out there in the field are going through, right, there's travel, which is stressful. Mm. Some dogs do really great on the road. Others get real nervous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Finn gets super excited because he's about to go find roosters. Mm-hmm. And so that excitement is stress. And that can lead to changes in the bacteria in their GI tract. And so helping kind of keep that nice and balanced, you've got Fortiflora. And I also like it from the sense of it's made with palatability enhancer. So if you've ever seen it, it comes in two forms, but I really like the powder because you can either sprinkle it on their food, because some dogs get so just jazzed about going to hunt that they will stop eating.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I don't understand that, because I'm like, if I'm running around, I am, yeah. I can't eat enough. But, you know, so it can help the food to kind of taste and smell better to them. Or you can use it to bait the water. So hydration for them. But 70% of their immune system is in their GI tract. And that's where, you know, they're absorbing all their nutrients. So if you want their endurance to be there, they need fuel in the tank. And if they're having, you know, the runs out the backside, they're not absorbing the nutrients from their food. Then you're also then diminishing their immune system. And are they going to be able to be healthy enough to stay out there with us and hunt? So Finn stays on Fortiflora through the entire hunting season.
Really?
It's just
whether
easier
traveling or not.
Yeah. It's just like, it's a routine for us. And I just know that that will just help with, you know, the fun of, and stress and excitement of and all the various species of poop that he likes to eat when we're out there.
Chocolate covered rabbit
turds.
Yeah,
it's delicious.
If your dog has like frequent GI issues,
yeah,
could you just add Fortiflora on a daily basis and just try and see if that rectifies it, or is that not a?
Yeah, no. I mean, certainly you'd want to talk to your veterinarian, right, if there's, you know, see make
something
sure,
going on.
Make sure there's nothing else going on. But there's nothing wrong with them being on a on Fortiflora every day. Mm. It's just like us, you know, drinking a probiotic drink or
yogurt.
Having yogurt or something like that.
Okay.
So yeah.
All right. Episode three: How do I prevent bird dog injuries? And Seth, we've done an entire podcast dedicated to mean seeds, grass-ons, but it is one of the frequent questions that comes in, like, you know, how do I avoid grass-ons? And the reality is they're natural. They're part of the native landscape. They're, you know, Canada wild rye, or you pick the grass, and most grass have awns. That's how they get planted, right? So it's hard to avoid them. So let's talk about preventative. So what can you do in a tailgate check to look for them? And then I've also encountered the longest winded question, but part A, part B, what can you do to look for them? But then also I've had friends that have had issues with grass on, but it's, there's always like this, it's hard to identify that the grass on is the problem until like 3-4 diagnosis, like, ah, we figured it out and that's what it is. Are there certain symptoms that dogs are experiencing that you could be like, well, process of elimination, that could be one of the things that you're dealing with. So again, no, longest winded question, but grass ons, well, help us through it.
I'll jump to B first, okay. Part B. So I think that you're right. It's what we call a diagnosis of exclusion. Mm. A lot of times we've ruled out everything else, and then this has got to be where we need to go hunting. A lot of times we see a situation in which a dog gets better on antibiotics, and then we finish the course of antibiotics, and there's that little window where it's fine, and then they start to regress, and the symptoms come right back. And that, at least in my mind, that says there's still what we call the nidus of infection somewhere. It's still
the
festering.
The foreign body is in there. It's in and there. And once the antibiotics are gone, then the infection is firing back up again.
And then we go on the hunt for it. So that's where we probably start with x-rays, especially if it's something that's respiratory in origin, like a cough or like a pneumonia looking thing. We just sort of try to move that direction next. So that's not really satisfying to hear, because that means you've ruled out a bunch of other things along the way. But it can act like a lot of other things. It can act like an upper respiratory infection. It can act like a sore paw. It can act like, I don't know, a joint soreness or whatever. I've seen it just masked in different ways.
Well, but when somebody brings in a bird dog and they're having respiratory issues, is that one of the first things that comes to your minds? Is it grass on, or is it?
It would depend on the age of the dog and concurrent things like that. It's always gonna, and it's also the time of year. You know, it's one of those things you're gonna encounter more like in that summer, early to mid fall type things. It would depend
August,
on where in the country you are. If you live in a place that's got those respiratory fungal diseases, which I tend to forget all about because I never encounter those in my part of the country. But those may be higher on my list than just a true grass on type injury.
And I would add to that when you're taking your dog in to tell your veterinarian, they might not know, you know, that you've been out hunting with them, or we travel so much to different parts of the country and things like that. So it may not be, unless you disclose that information to us, it may, you know, that may change kind of where we list our differentials of for the diagnosis and things like that. So as much as you can tell us about where your dog has been and what they've been doing, the better we can direct either the diagnostics and or the treatment then that follows.
Gets back to the dog's not going to tell.
It's not going to tell us.
So
nope.
So the owner, as much as they can offer, even if it's, you know, just the geography or where they've been traveling.
Exactly.
Or, hey, this is a hunting dog. You know, we've been out in heavy grass, and maybe this is one of the things that we need to eliminate.
Yep.
Yeah. And when there's one in the nose, I mean, that's pretty obvious. There's like you've never seen a being so inconsolable as a bird dog that's got a grass on in its nostril. I mean, it's just like they look so miserable and trying to get it out. So that's something that's like we're going to jump right to looking in there and pulling out a grass seed. But when I was in rural practice in Lewiston, Idaho, I mean, every single pet that came in with the limp was a burrowed grass on in the foot somewhere until proven otherwise.
Wow.
So in that case, we kind of did jump towards it. We had much fewer cases of the respiratory kind, the ones that migrated into the chest or thorax.
So there's a little bit of geography to it.
Yep. And that was cheatgrass for sure in that area. So it's a little bit stubbier of a plant. Huh. But we saw a lot of it.
So tailgate check.
Yeah. So that's part A.
So nose probably pretty obvious.
Yeah.
In the foot, you got to check between the toes.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out that all these grass-ons, the ones like that are going to migrate somewhere bad, all start out pretty benign, just like laying in the hair or laying in the skin or gently nestled between the toes. So these are places that you have to check, you know, right away. And so they're going to start out just laying there. If you can eliminate them then there's never going to be a problem. So I'm kind of more looking at those breeds that have longer coats, you know, your setters and things like that.
So it holds in the on and sort of inadvertently pushes it under the skin.
Yeah, they're designed to migrate in one direction mm-hmm. pretty efficiently, and it's part of their adaptation to their environment too. And so yeah, you have to kind of find them where they're at. You know, ear flaps between the toes is a common spot. Mm-hmm. You know, the groin and armpit areas. And one that I always mention to people, they never think about it, is like in the females, like around the external genitalia, because they squat to pee, so that area is coming in contact with that cheatgrass very often. And I've had a lot of major infections back there that they act like, you know, urinary tract infections until we realize, oh, there's a grass on
wow.
stuck up in there. Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, it's funny, like you do a tailgate check and you kind of do it all real cursory, right? Yeah. Like you look in the eyes, try to make sure there's nothing in the eyes. You're looking for a little, if there's blood anywhere or anything, but you know, done in 30 seconds, nothing obvious, we're all good. But it is really important, like check between each of the toes, and you can avoid a lot of heartache if you just take, instead of 30 seconds, maybe 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And dive a little deeper.
Yeah. And I also love it from the fact that it gives that dog an opportunity to kind of cool down before you're going to throw them in the box or put them in the kennel or, you know, however else you're transporting them back. And so that can help with recovery as well. So to me, the tailgate check is critically important from keeping a potentially small issue from getting into something bigger, but then also helping with endurance and recovery.
Right. All right. Episode 4, another one of my fear ones. Yeah, you know, I'm glad you're both happy people, because I keep keep going down the scare avenue here. But I guess we all fear something happened to our bird dogs, right? And one thing that I've never had this happen, but I do fear it, and it comes in all sorts of different names: twisted stomach, stomach distension, gastric torsion, bloat. Those are all essentially the same thing, are they not?
Yes.
Okay, so and for me to describe it, what I understand it to be is, so if you think about a swing set, that's your dog's stomach, and if you put food in the swing set, this is really odd. Bob West told me this a long time ago. So you put food in the swing set, and dog starts running, hunting, and the swing set flips over itself. In other words, the intestine flip, or the stomach flips at the intestine, and then you got blockage.
Yep.
And that's where twisted stomach, flip stomach, and then you got a big problem, because nothing's going in, nothing's going out, and now you got potentially deadly issue.
Yep.
So the way to avoid this, I've always been taught, is double feed in the evenings before a hunting day. Like, and my dogs love going on hunting trips because they get second dinners, but they don't ever get breakfast, which, again, it's, you know, we anthropomorphize our pups.
Yep.
And we wake up and scramble some eggs, or, you know, eat the continental breakfast at the Holiday Inn Express. And like, well, we got to give Fido, you know, some energy for the morning. Yep. And Bob was like, no, not me, Bob, but Bob West. And like, no, just feed them, get all that energy in the evening, and they're going to empty it all out. But all it's in their body, it's running through, and that will prevent the twisted stomach. So I'm not a veterinarian. So Ruthann, did I explain the thought process here on how to avoid it correctly?
Yeah. So yes and no.
Okay.
So the description of the swing, accurate.
Okay.
Sometimes it also pulls in other friends like the spleen and those sorts of things.
Oh, wow.
And so that can get real bad real fast. So you do what you can to limit it.
Okay.
And so the feeding in the evening is great. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to, you're going to prevent it and avoid it.
Oh, really?
It.
Okay. I always thought like I did this in the, I'm free and clear.
Yeah, unfortunately, no.
Okay.
You still need the little bee in the back of your brain because we don't know. We do things that help to limit the risk, but can't eliminate it. Because sometimes it happens with just
Could it happen with water?
It can happen with water. It can happen for no reason.
Hmm.
So especially like our deep-chested dogs, those are predisposed. We know just from the anatomy of them. And so people will sometimes, if like they're spaying their dog or, you know, even if neutering while they're under anesthesia, they'll go and they'll tack their stomach. So they kind of literally stitch it to the side of the abdominal wall.
Mm-hmm.
And that can, again, that is probably, I guess, as close to eliminating it as you can.
Yeah.
Obviously, those stitches could dissolve and other things. But back to your original, if we also think about, like, us after Thanksgiving dinner, right? Like, none of us want to go and, like, when you go out to play football with your cousins, you know, you're like, oh, I've got this food baby that's, like, swinging around, right? So it doesn't feel good for them if we feed them and then go hunt. You know, it takes about 18 to 24 hours for food to move through the dog's entire GI tract. Depending on the data you look at, it's maybe 4 to 6 hours for it to empty from the stomach. So that's a while. And beyond just the actual physical, like, distension of their stomach and all of that, we're looking at what the purpose of feeding them is, right? Is to give the nutrients to the muscles, to their lungs, to their immune system, to all that, to get them out there with us. So that takes energy to digest their food. So we want them to be doing that while we're not also asking their muscles to be doing that activity and running and hunting and doing all of that. So I like to equate it to kind of like, if you're leaving at 3 a.m. on a road trip, the next morning, you go the night before to the gas station and you top off your gas tank in your car. It's that same way for our dogs. So it's like you want that fuel to be in their system, being digested and utilized so that they can literally hit the ground running the next morning with you. It also takes moisture to do that. So we will, you know, for Finn, we float his food. I now pretty much do it every day just because I'm in the routine. And I also don't want to admit that hunting season is over. so we keep floating the food. We can still find birds. But you know, in that, again, that moisture is helping to start the ease the digestive process, but then also he doesn't have to take the moisture from his body to help to digest that food.
Okay.
So it's kind of, you know, multifactorial in feeding them their bulk of their calories the night before.
Okay. So if you do it in the morning, are you tipping the scales towards this could happen or not necessarily?
Oh, for sure.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah, you're tempting fate.
And how many hours is safe? Like if you wake up at 5 a.m. and you got a five-hour drive, is a five-hour window enough? Or
you're decreasing the risk, but you're still – like that food is still having to be digested as they are out there even working. 5 hours later working. And so you're straining a system that you could easily avoid that strain by feeding them the night before.
Okay.
I will say Finn, as much as I love him, he can be somewhat of a knucklehead if he doesn't get breakfast in the morning or anything. So during hunting season, we will, like, I'll give him just a little handful of kibble so he won't be hangry and he will, you know, be less troublesome out there in the field. But it literally is just a little handful that we throw in the bowl.
Okay.
I float it that time too. And then typically we have a little drive before we go hunt. So
I've seen like pace, like you're a marathoner, right?
Yeah.
Like that quick acting carbs. Are those sort of things easier on a dog's ability to digest or not necessarily?
Not necessarily. And our dogs really love, like, their fuel for endurance is fat, which again is a more complex thing for them to digest, which takes more energy to digest as well and more time. So those quick carbs, you know, in emergency situations, hypoglycemia in your hunting dogs, really, really important. But you know, for them, it's really going to be that complete and balanced diet the night before.
I asked that question. I see
I'm squirming.
I know. You're
sitting on my hands literally.
You're like, Bob, you're asking human-oriented questions over there.
No, I mean, I think you're right about the tendency to anthropomorphize there. And I, you know, Ruth Ann did an excellent explanation of all that, but I wanted to add that dogs just, they seem to thrive in that state of, like, not necessarily ketosis, but they're like endurance athletes that their body will run on reserves so efficiently.
Yeah.
They perform so well. So you feeling the need to feed that dog in the morning is really more about you.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see in the rare instance, of course, where you have a genetic hypoglycemic or hypoglycemic tendency dog, which is rare.
Yeah.
Then in that case, it's, you have your own set of issues. But this for most dogs, they need, like, fasted is how they're going to perform mm-hmm. optimally. And then you recharge them after the hunt's over at night, and then they're going to spend the rest of that evening rebuilding those reserves to then burn off the subsequent day.
Is it safe to say that we all should spend 100% more time thinking about hydration than worrying about nutrition on the day during a hunt?
Absolutely. And those, I don't think dogs need that little sugar bump. I just don't feel like they have to have it. Again, there's a few that probably have unique medical conditions where that's required, but for the most part, that's really about you and how hungry you are in the moment.
Yeah. Worry about feeding at yeah. night before.
Yeah.
Worry about getting them water.
We've all seen dogs, the second you turn them loose in the field, what's like the first thing they do, right? They go poop pretty much.
Yeah.
And get it, and that starts the process of anything that's in there is going to get evacuated and rushed out. If you've put in your nice, you know, high quality dog food in that system, it's mm-hmm. not going to stick around long enough to be absorbed. It's going to get pushed out in this process. So it's, you know, it's not worth putting it in there to begin with.
You mentioned deep-chested dogs,
yep.
right? And I think I know what you mean, right? I think I know the breeds, but for sake of clarity, give us some breeds that are have a high propensity to this issue.
Yeah, so maybe not as much in the hunting space, but certainly like our Great Danes. I mean, I guess they still hunt. Irish Wolfhounds, things like, you know, our Greyhounds we'll see. Mm. We recently had a friend who lost their St. Bernard with it.
Really?
And so, yeah, there's a whole host.
Yeah, Draughts are like Draughts, the ones I yeah. feel like I've seen in the hunting space. Those big, tall German Shorthairs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any breed where the distance between the deepest part of the chest and the tucked tummy is really pronounced. You mm. kind of see them from the profile view. Those are the ones I worry about.
Okay.
It's a strong genetic predisposition towards that. It's not just diet and timing of diet.
All right. Episode 5, what supplements should I consider for my bird dog? And I thought about... Well, we'll just do a whole episode on CBD and THC, but we'll save that for later. We don't want to get the lawyers involved on this particular podcast. So I did think about glucosamine chondroitin. All my dogs, I've started using that at roughly around age 6. And I feel like it's been a very beneficial supplement for my dogs as they've aged. And it... It makes, again, anthropomorphizing, you know, it's like, well, if it works at age 6, why wouldn't I start at age 3? You know, is there any advantage, Ruthann, to using glucosamine for their joints, you know, since 1, 3, 6, younger? Is there a magic age, or is it breed dependent? How do you answer that?
Yeah, so with glucosamine and chondroitin, I'll take a step back. We don't have a whole lot of great evidence that it's mixed out there on what it does and how it works for the dogs. There's a lot of going back to the anthropomorphism of the owner. Oftentimes will say, "Well, I feel like he is doing better, or mm-hmm. he is more active." But like, if you go down to the hardcore data, it doesn't, like the activity monitors and things like that don't necessarily support that. But so is it a placebo effect that the owner is
feeling
experiencing?
Good about.
Yeah. But there's also, I will say, we know those are building blocks for natural cartilage in the dog's body. There's nothing that says it's going to cause detriment.
Mm.
So why not? Right. You're like, it might help. It won't hurt, so let's throw it
except,
in there.
Except for the old wallet.
Right. Except for the wallet.
A little painful there.
But there are other, you know, there's a whole laundry list of different supplements and different compounds that we know help to support joint health.
Mm.
We know there's good research with omega-3s. Hyaluronic acid is another one. There's Attaquan is the generic or the brand name. The generic is polysulfated glycosaminoglycans, which is a really long word.
Say that
word.
5 times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. And there are things like green lip muscles. And there's, again, we could spend a whole episode talking about that. From my opinion, I mean, it goes back to, I think we talked about, but like with supplements, you want to make sure it's that there's some sort of third party verification of what's on the outside is what's on the inside. More so because you also want to make sure there's nothing harmful or toxic that might have gotten in there. And because back to the wallet, if you're going to be paying for something, you want it to actually be in the supplement that you're giving. I look at it like with our sporting dogs, they are out there. They are, you know, high performing athletes, pretty much from the time their paws hit the ground at, you know, 1 day of age. So, you know, looking at that, you know, I don't think 6 weeks when they're weaned, you know, is too early to start them on that. They are going to be wearing and tearing their bodies in different ways and contortions than we can even ever imagine. And so having them on that supplement, I think is, you know, would not be a bad decision.
Do you use glucosamine for your pups?
I do.
You do. What about you, Seth?
I'll add to that. I think the research is actually pretty strong of starting those susceptible breeds, and I'm thinking about mostly Labradors here for your listeners. Starting them at a very young age is beneficial, and so that's I'm compelled by what they've shown there. In my own though, I tend to sort of wait until 5 to 6 years of age, and then in short hairs, it tends to be less of a problem because they're kind of lighter framed dogs. But that's a blanket statement, I think. But if I see any signs of arthritis, probably means I should have started a year earlier, and then I'll, you know, start it as ASAP.
Right. Ruthann, you mentioned omega-3 fatty acids, right?
Yeah.
We all know that. You know, it's like fish oil.
Yep.
So I've heard of people using just fish oil pills for their dog for this purpose.
Yeah.
Good, bad, innocuous.
Yeah, I would say, again, making sure, because we can see, like with fish oil, there can be heavy metals that are associated with that. So again, making sure that it's a manufacturer that does that quality and safety and has that third party guarantee. And then it is dose dependent. So you want to make sure that I think it would take a lot to give an overdose of omega-3s.
You get diarrhea first.
Yeah. Before they're actually going to get toxic from it. But there is a therapeutic dose. So like throwing one fish oil capsule for your, you know, 65, 70 pound Labrador is not going to be a therapeutic dose for them. So working with your veterinarian to really get that. And then there are foods that already have omega-3s put in there to help out as well. So there's kind of, you know, multiple ways to get that into their system.
Yeah, most dogs don't overdose on fish. They just roll in it.
Right. Exactly.
All right. Episode 6, our final episode of the first half of Ask a Vet series, brought to you by Purina Pro Plan. Very popular topic. Seth, you tackled this one. When should I spay or neuter my bird dog? And it was interesting how he answered this, Seth. He said, strong benefit to waiting longer in sporting breeds, particularly physical and mental benefits. So explain a little bit why sporting breeds versus other breeds, you like to wait a little longer before you spay or neuter.
Well, I think for a couple reasons. One, I feel like most people that are listening to this podcast right now are generally responsible pet owners. Like us hunting dog people, we tend to pay close attention to what our dogs are up to. We're keeping an eye on them. And the risk of them just wandering the streets, getting pregnant or impregnating things is pretty minimal. That doesn't hold true for everyone that owns a pet, as you can imagine. So in that case, we get the leniency or the whatever you want to call
it. There's like a Bob Barker statement.
Right.
Sort of anti-Bob Barker statement. He's got into us a lot of trouble with it. So we've seen over time that a lot of issues that have arisen that we can correlate to this push to early spay and neuter everything. I don't know that you can say it's definitive proof, but there's a strong correlation, and it gets people thinking that maybe we should do things a little differently in our sporting breeds. I think there are risks and benefits to every decision you would make in that regard. There's some benefits to being spayed early. There's some benefits to being spayed at all. There's also some benefits to never being spayed. And you kind of have to decide, like, what risks am I comfortable with and which ones am I not, and then kind of make a decision that's sort of custom tailored to your dog. But I do think in terms of like physical development, once all the growth plates are closed, once the musculature is established and the ligaments are secured and the body is like in its...
And what's a rough time frame when that happens?
2 years old is thrown out a lot, okay. 18 months to 2 years. Okay. It really varies. Some breeds are fast matures and some are a little bit slower.
Okay.
That to me is a point in which the body is sort of like finished its growth phase. Mm. And then if you remove the hormones, which drive that growth phase and tell it to stop naturally on its own, then your risk of causing some issue related to that disrupting that phase mm-hmm. is reduced. So that's kind of that's part of that question there. Mm. And then what was the other segment? So
just
why sporting breeds.
Yeah. Why yeah. versus, your why, general dogs.
Yeah. And I feel like I answered that. Yeah. There's just a different set of parameters that we can live by with having a higher level of responsibility with animals.
Well,
I got it, Bob. Sorry. You said mental maturity.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so that's kind of another piece that I wanted to throw in there. And that was looking at hormones and the way that the brain utilizes them for behaviors that we can all recognize, like marking and roaming and those sort of things. And then like and there's just a part of the brain needs those to fully develop. And there's been a study, and it was looking at Vizslas really, which are, you know, general consensus is they're a little bit more of a sensitive breed.
Mm-hmm.
So
the Velcro dog.
Yeah, the Velcro dog, the classic Velcro dog. So in that breed where they looked at a cohort of dogs that were, you know, fear-based behaviors, like high anxiety, fear-based aggression, almost all those dogs had a history of also early spay and neuter.
Hmm.
So there's something about the brain requiring those hormones to reach a stable state, and then removing those too early could cause a disruption in that.
Hmm.
Again, a correlation, not a direct causality, but I think it's pretty compelling there too.
So yeah. Interesting.
And I'd add the other thing with spaying and neutering. Now, this isn't, I see it not as big of an issue in our sporting dogs, but certainly we know it drops their metabolism by about 25 to 30%. And so that is something really, if you do go about that, that's another thing to just take into consideration, the amount of calories that are going in, because we know, you know, obesity will shorten their life and health span. So we want to keep them nice and lean, and their intact state can certainly influence that.
When I've talked to vets, like the number one thing they always bring up, like it's obesity that causes the majority of problems, and not just bird dogs, but all dogs. Is that
for sure?
I mean, you both are nodding instantly. Yeah. Like, it's like exercise your dogs, don't overfeed, and watch the treats.
Yeah.
I think don't overfeed, then exercise.
Yes.
And then what?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. All three of those things, right?
Yeah. But it's, 80% diet and 20% activity. So, and oftentimes it's more things beyond just what they put in the bowl. And I'll do my one public service announcement of when your veterinarian asks you how much do you feed and you say 2 cups, we are asking you as if they were measuring cups. So how many 8-ounce cups? Because if you tell me you're like, I only feed my 80-pound Labrador 2 cups of food a day. I don't know how he gained this much weight, but it's actually like the big gulp cup from your local convenience store. That is a very different volume. Yeah. We are looking for the 8-ounce measurements.
Right. So before I go to closing thoughts, I do want to thank you both, whether or not you know, so many people have these questions about their best friend, their partner.
Yeah.
You know, we as bird hunters, the joy we experience comes first through those dogs, right? Like you said, you've become an adult onset hunter because of watching this, you know, bird hunting happen through a dog. And I think whether or not it's the singular thing that got you hooked, it's a major point for all of us. And thank you for sharing your knowledge and sharing, you know, not only the veterinarian stuff, but the Purina Pro Plan story. How many isn't it 500 veterinarians work for Purina?
500 researchers and scientists. We're not all veterinarians over there.
I mean, it's insane number,
insane.
Right?
It's insane, yes.
So it's really, I mean, and we as an organization, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, are super proud to have had Purina, you know, for virtually 40 years as our national dog food sponsor, and have you guys invest so much money, not only in the science of the food, but then also in our habitat mission. And you see that full circle connection to, you know, places to run your dogs and see the joy and having them healthy and fit and well cared for. So long-winded thank you to both of you as veterinarians and ambassadors for Purina, sharing your knowledge in what you do for our organization. Closing thoughts. We'll start with Seth. We'll let Ruth Ann have the mic drop on this one. closing thoughts that, you know, we got six more episodes of Ask the Vet. But, you know, as we head into this episode, you know, it's going to run springtime. We're heading into the off season. We're already in the off season. You know, maybe something that our listeners should be thinking about this spring and summer.
Sure. I get a question a lot. Is it, should I keep my dog on like a performance dog food year round? Mm. And then the short answer is the science would suggest that you should. Mm. And just remember that the metabolic requirement is much lower when the dogs aren't in peak activity time. So you have to account for that in the bowl. The reason behind that is kind of fun. I feel like the cells within the body that create all this energy have, you know, what's called mitochondria. Mm. And then the presence of high fat that you're going to find in these performance dog foods, like their Sport 3020.
Mm-hmm. Is with the short hair on the bag.
Of course. Bag. Yeah. For good reason. For good reason. You know, that the presence of fat tells their bodies to upregulate the mitochondria. Here's the fat says, you're going to use this. Let's make more energy. And so that's a pretty fantastic physiological process. It takes time to happen. So if you're looking to maximize their performance in October, if you're going to switch them off of a sporting, performance food in the off season, you need to give them 2 to 3 months of time to get kickstart that process. If you start at the beginning of the season, you may be wrapping up your season by the time they've reached their full potential.
Mm. That's interesting. How long have we known this?
Oh,
it's relatively
a couple
new.
20 years or more.
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean, I think it's like it's now being said
in
these circles.
Yeah.
But I think the research has been around for quite a while.
Yeah.
It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it is for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Mic drop time, Ruth Ann.
Oh, mic drop.
Go Tigers.
Go Tigers. I would say, I mean, I think it's important for us to keep in mind that these dogs are athletes. And so expecting them, now that we are entering kind of this off-season summertime, don't forget about the conditioning. Don't forget about doing, you know, I'm certified in acupuncture and rehab. So we do a lot of like core strength work, and doing those little things in the off season can help set them up for success as we venture out in the fall. So really not, you know, don't forget about them. Mm-hmm. Their mental health and well-being is important as well.
That was where my mind was going too. It's like we focus so much on their body. For good reason, because you see these obese dogs causing all sorts of problems. But also, I see it in my own dogs. You know, if they've been sitting on the sofa, the Barca while I'm, at the home office, they're like, can we play a freaking game or what?
Right.
Let's do something.
Yeah.
Not just their body. They want to use their mind too.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that's what makes them rock stars out there in the field.
Yeah.
So you can't, they don't just shut that off in the off season.
Yeah.
So making sure you're doing things to engage their brains in the off season. So again, they can hit the ground running come fall.
Awesome. Thank you both for doing this.
Yeah.
Dr. Ruth Ann Lobo, this was your first podcast.
This with you. Yes, it is.
Great. And Seth, this was like number three,
two or four? Three,
Thank you both for doing this.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We'll do it again after we finish the next cycle of Ask a Vet series. So, folks, you can find them on the Pheasants Forever website or the Quail Forever website. Just Google Ask a Vet. It's brought to you by Purina Pro Plan. They're fantastic. They're like 2 to 4 minute clips. And, you know, you got questions about all sorts of things, supplements, spaying. It's all there for you to learn. It'll, you know, help you ask the right questions in your own vet. So please check it out. And I am Bob St. Pierre reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks, folks.